1460 WVOX.
Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nina Lubin, and we're coming to you on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX, 1460 AM, and, of course, our talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. So, happy summer, Nina. How are you doing?
Just fine. The weather has been lovely, and we had the great, I guess, let me call it a blessing, of being around to see the longest day of the year yesterday. I was watching a light sky till about 9:30, 9:45 p.m., and even though it happens every year, and it's been happening in my life for decades, it's a thing to behold.
So, absolutely. I was grateful. Walking through Central Park yesterday afternoon in the sunshine and thinking I'm so ready for summer. So we've got a great show scheduled today, but before we leap into today's show, we'd like to remind listeners that the primary election is going to be held on June 28th, and that early voting period, that is now through June 26th. And this is your opportunity to vote for your party's candidate for governor, lieutenant governor, and assembly.
Yeah. The 2022 primaries, as some listeners may already know, have been split between two dates, one in June, the other in August. Here's a quick rundown. First, voters have the opportunity to vote now, as Tamar just noted, for their party's state assembly candidate and gubernatorial candidate. That takes place in early voting until June 26th, and on the actual primary day, June 28th. Second, voters will have the opportunity to vote for their party's state senate and congressional representative on August 23rd, with presumably some early voting leading up to the 23rd. This rather confusing split makes it more important than ever for all voters to have access to accurate, unbiased information about who's going to be on the ballot, what will be on the ballot, and when that vote is supposed to happen. The League of Women Voters of New Rochelle is pleased to offer voters just that information with our voter guide on vote411.org, V-O-T-E 411.org. It's a one-stop shop for election-related information that provides nonpartisan information to the public. At vote411.org, New Yorkers can register to vote, to see what's on the ballot, and to see where candidates stand on the issues that matter in our community. Vote 411 is a League of Women Voters project that serves millions of voters every election. It's a trusted source of objective and nonpartisan election information. Using Vote 411 before heading to the polls helps you make informed decisions and gives everyone an equal voice in democracy.
We'd like also to let our listeners know about a hotline that's being operated by the New York State Attorney General's office, which voters can call if they're turned away from voting or have any kind of trouble at the polls. The hotline's number is, if you have a pen ready, 866-390-2992. That number is 866-390-2992. So with that, let's turn to today's show. Nina, would you like to do the honors?
Sure do, and it is definitely an honor. Our guest today, Dr. Carlos Vargas Ramos, received his PhD in political science from Columbia University and holds a master's degree in Hispanic civilization from New York University. For the last decade, Dr. Vargas Ramos has been integrally involved with CENTRO, the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. CENTRO is the largest university-based research institute in the United States dedicated to the Puerto Rican experience. Dr. Vargas Ramos teaches political science and sociology courses at Columbia University and Barnard College. He is the author or editor of books, book chapters, articles, and policy papers that are far too numerous to detail here. And Dr. Vargas Ramos, a political scientist, has in fact worked directly in politics via positions with the New York City Council and with the U.S. Department of Commerce.
So what caught our eye about Dr. Vargas Ramos was his May 12th op-ed in the online publication City and State New York. It's about New York State's redistricting process, which is now over after a whole series of failures and deep, very deep disappointments. His article grapples with the fact that despite the time and energy spent by the news media, voting rights advocates, good government groups, and politicians to explain and evaluate the process while it was happening, most Americans really still don't know much at all about redistricting. And until they understand this very insular, very confusing process and get meaningfully involved in it, Dr. Vargas Ramos holds that the public will continue to suffer negative consequences like, for example, the marginalization of different population groups.
In other words, education is needed. But how does such broad redistricting education occur in the population? And how does genuinely meaningful involvement happen? These are questions we invited our guest here to discuss. So thank you for joining us this morning, Dr. Vargas Ramos. Welcome to the Ballot Box.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And good morning to you both. And thank you for the invitation to come to the show.
Our pleasure.
So your goals for better education around the redistricting process are to empower all citizens. But let's briefly narrow the focus to Hispanic groups in New York. What does the data tell us about how marginalization has impacted Hispanics?
Yeah, well, marginalization has happened historically, not just presently, but historically, as a result of the fact that access to the process by which laws are made, laws are conceived, have been limited. And one way in which this access to the process of, you know, making laws and decision-making, public decision-making more generally, has entailed limiting access to the ballot box, limiting access to registering to vote. And then if you are empowered to register and to turn out to vote, not actually be mobilized to vote. You are not recruited historically. I'm talking historically here. You have not been recruited to participate as a candidate in the electoral process. You are not named to commissions, advisory groups, you know, decision-making bodies. And that in itself, when you are not involved, you also turn off those who might potentially become involved in this decision-making process, in this political process.
And you feel that the redistricting process is, for lack of a better word, unfriendly to those groups?
It is so obscure that you turn people off by, you know, the fact that people don't know what it entails. I mean, what does redistricting mean in a common person's mind, in an ordinary citizen? It's very obscure. Oh, yeah, they are dividing congressional seats. Oh, yeah, they are dividing state senate seats. They are, right now in New York City, they are reworking the council districts. What does that mean? What does it entail, and what are the consequences? And that is from an utter lack of understanding of the implications of what redistricting is. I mean, first of all, we need to know what redistricting is so people can become involved in redistricting.
Correct. We are coming to a break, and when we come back, let us talk about what, in fact, redistricting is. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, welcome back. Our guest this morning is political scientist Dr. Carlos Vargas Ramos, and we are discussing redistricting with him. Carlos, let's continue the discussion about redistricting by going back to the basics for just a minute. Each state, the states redistrict once every 10 years based on the census numbers. The idea, as I believe Tamar mentioned, is to kind of divide the population into roughly equal legislative districts so that each legislator represents roughly the same number of citizens. And of course, doing that ultimately maintains the Democratic goal of one person, one vote in the House of Representatives and in state legislatures. This seems to be a task involving basic math. Do the division. So where and how does the problem of marginalization arise in what seems to be a mathematical process?
Right. So as you pointed out, and you're correct in that description of what redistricting is the equal apportionment, or as equal as mathematically and logistically possible, to have districts that have roughly either the same number of persons within the district or as close to that equality as possible. The thing is that is only one criterion out of many that in New York State we use in the redistricting process. So certainly districts must have roughly the same population to preserve that one person, one vote principle, which is bedrock for our democratic republic. But it's also must conform to other criteria. The district must be compact and contiguous. You need to preserve political subdivisions. You must not deny or abridge the voting rights of racial and language minorities, because there has been a history of abridging or denying such voting rights. But in addition, you also need to maintain somewhat more abstract concepts such as communities of interest, right? And this is something that is, you know, more subjective and therefore, you know, hard to pin down and to establish concrete criteria for. And this is where the public needs to contribute to the process, just not relying on a geometric or a geographical distribution of the population.
I've heard the term community of interest batted around a lot over the past year, and I still haven't gotten a sense of what the term means. It seems like it could be people interested in water rights for an area. It could be people who feel like they have certain things that unite them ethnically. What exactly is a community of interest?
Well, I mean, that is to be defined, you know, and it tends to be defined by people in discrete or as discrete a geographic area as possible, because it may transcend specific geographic areas. You definitely have ethnic communities that may be split, and by splitting those ethnic communities among among two or three or more districts, you are diluting the power of those ethnic communities to elect representatives of their choosing. But you may also have other communities of interest. They may be economic, like, are you going to dilute the power of an agricultural community merging it with suburban or urban communities? Things of that nature need to be taken into consideration. And the people who know where what their communities are the people who form part of those communities.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like even within the criteria for redistricting, there are conflicts. There are back and forths. Mm-hmm. And that some of these criteria, like the straight math division into groups, you know, into areas of certain numbers, call for a math equation, and others are really subject to are subject to subjectivism, to different people's opinions or desires. And my
And that is precisely why it is a political process.
Right.
And subject to maybe sometimes unhealthy political influence.
And that's the aspect, because we're discussing here after, if there was no inherent interest by established institutions to try to maximize their influence over the outcomes of whether it is the redistricting process, the electoral process, or what have you.
You know, the thing, as we said in introducing you, that caught our eye about your whole thesis on redistricting was your article in City and State New York. And you stated that meaningful public participation in redistricting involves a public education campaign along with public participation promotion campaign. How do you envision these kind of campaigns taking form?
I take a cue, although, you know, this is not perfect, from the actual effort to hold the census, right? We hold the same way that redistricting takes place every 10 years. Well, the census, the decennial census, takes place every 10 years in the service of redistricting. You know, people forget that one of the primary missions, if not the primary mission of the decennial census, is to apportion the districts among the several states and within a state, proportionately to that population. So every 10 years we hold a decennial census. In 2020, it was very fraught, not just because of the challenges that the COVID-19 pandemic created for everybody, but in this case for the Census Bureau, but also because of the political attempts to hold the census fairly.
Okay, and break again rather quickly, too quickly. But when we come back, we'll continue talking about the census and redistricting and what meaningful involvement is. Thank you.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. Our guest once more is Professor Carlos Vargas Ramos, and our topic is redistricting. And Professor Vargas Ramos is speaking to us about his ideas on how to have meaningful public participation in redistricting. So, Carlos, we, before the break, were trying to flesh out how public education campaigns along with public participation promotion campaigns could take form. Maybe you could expand on that?
Yes. So again, the same way that we spend millions of dollars in publicizing the census, the decennial census, so that people would answer those questionnaires that would come into people's mailboxes, and you know, it did have a positive effect in that, you know, over 2/3 of the population of the households responded generally. We need to have, at the same time, you know, a campaign that indicates that, in addition to bringing in millions of dollars into people's communities if they respond to the census accurately, you also be contributing to the process of redistricting, because we need to divide the legislative districts every 10 years. So, and at that time, you just by making people aware that this is the process that is already beginning, and is beginning with the decennial census, groups that are likely to participate in the process ultimately, because, you know, frankly, not everybody is going to be participating in this process.
So you're speaking about civics education by mail, in other words, to households.
Well, that would be one component. It would be a component of also informing civic organizations throughout the country, throughout the state, throughout our towns and cities, that this process is beginning. This is beginning with the population count. And at that point, people can start paying attention to both the decennial census as well as the outcomes of that decennial census. They need to empower by educating local civic groups, whether it is, you know, the League of Women Voters have been very involved in this process for a long time, but other groups, neighborhood associations, block associations, communities of faith, to the extent that they become involved in the civic process. You need to have in the school system, perhaps having contests among students to see if they can draw the best assembly districts for their communities, things of this nature. But it needs to begin with a public education campaign and a public awareness campaign that this is happening.
So grassroots mobilization, in other words.
Correct. Now, it needs to be sponsored and fostered by our representative institutions, such as the legislatures, whether it is the New York City Legislature, the City Council, or the New York State Legislature, the Assembly and the Senate collectively. So it needs to be an effort in which people participate. But of course, there may be less of an interest in those quarters from having many people involved in the process, because that also then reduces their own influence in the process.
So going back to what you were saying about starting with children, I'm curious, do you think the federal government has an affirmative role in prioritizing and resourcing K through 12 civic education to encourage more civically engaged electorates?
You could say that the federal government has that in mind. However, we know that education is a more local process. Not just at the state level, but specifically at the level of local communities. So I would say that it should be coming basically from the state level down, because, again, if we start bringing in the federal government into this process, you know, you start having arguments as to the role of the federal government in local education. Certainly, the federal government may want to encourage, they may want to finance these public education campaigns, but I will place the onus at the state level.
Okay, Carlos, your focus, of course, is as a teacher at Columbia, at Centro Hunter College, undergraduate and a graduate university students. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, though, if any, on how the states are doing at the K through 12 level, or maybe let's just say New York State is doing at the K through 12 level in getting this civics education started?
It varies. Yeah, there are some schools and some schools within some specific school districts that are doing very well. These tend to be your better schools, the ones that get the most funding, and they tend to get the best teachers and the best students. And then there are others that don't do as well. So there is a wide disparity mm-hmm. in terms of the quality of education across the state, across the cities and towns throughout the state. So it depends.
Okay.
But in any event, it can be better. And not only can it be better, it must be better.
Agreed.
When we were talking about whether the federal government has a responsibility, I think I read there are only 9 states that actually mandate civic classes to students K through 12, which is incredible. We have so much emphasis on STEM education. I think it's eclipsing a lot of other aspects of what we assume is in our children's curriculum.
And what we forget also is that, because oftentimes we talk about whether education, public education, is a right, is that to the extent that the courts have held that this is a requirement that the state governments or the local government must undertake, is because so we can form citizens, people who can take part in the public decision-making process, and they can serve in juries. So perhaps the standards that we could be having at the school in the school system is to make sure that, for instance, can these students serve meaningfully in a jury? Can they answer public questions that appears on ballots on a regular basis?
Speaking of public responsibility, let me just throw this in because I faced this question numerous times when, in fact, talking about civics education and redistricting education. And the answer I've gotten, and I'm wondering if you can give me a snappy, fast response to it, is look, New York had an independent redistricting commission. It traveled across the state seeking public comments from everyone at public hearings. People came. Isn't that enough involvement? Isn't the responsibility for getting to those hearings on us? What's the quick answer to that one?
The answer is that the Independent Redistricting Commission was not well conceived, and therefore their budget was not allocated quickly, and therefore they were late to start. And as a result of the lateness in the decennial census figures, the whole process delayed. So there were very many reasons for why this redistricting process ended in failure, so that it had to be resolved by the courts. And ultimately, the structure of the redistricting process in New York State was not optimal.
Okay, as we seem to have found. So I'm imagining that the just having public comments at a public hearing is far less than you're talking about. You really are talking.
It is not. The Constitution requires that the redistricting commission not only provides a space for the public to review, analyze, and comment on the plans and to develop alternative redistricting plans, but in order to develop an alternative redistricting plan, the people need to have the data. Mm. And the data was not accessible from the IRC's website or any other way unless people like us went directly to the Census Bureau website, downloaded the data, created the maps, and came up with an analysis. And we ourselves, we didn't find it incumbent upon ourselves to recommend that certain districts be drawn in a particular manner. We were only able to comment on how some of the proposed maps helped to dilute, in our case, Hispanic political representation.
Where is that dilution greatest at this point?
The dilution was greatest in places like New York City, which is where, for the purposes of the Hispanic population, most of us are located, certainly downstate. There were attempts to eliminate districts that were represented by Hispanic representatives in the House of Representatives. There were attempts to dilute the number of residents of districts that were of Hispanic original descent, even though ultimately the maps that were proposed proposed to the legislature, were better than the ones that were originally proposed and revealed to the public. But we find that because of the concentration in particular areas of the state, that may contribute to the dilution.
All right. Thank you, and we will be back after the break to talk further about how census results have affected the redistricting process. Hi, welcome back to the Ballot Box. Our guest again is Professor Carlos Vargas Ramos, and we were talking before the break about the marginalization of the Hispanic community in New York City's redistricting process. So, Carlos, here's a question from the Hudson Valley. Census results indicate that growing suburban Hudson Valley counties from Westchester to Dutchess, they're increasingly less white, which reflects state and national trends. And in the latest census, those counties saw increases in Black, Latino, and Asian communities. But Westchester's new congressional districts, which are the 16th and 17th districts, look more white by at least 7 percentage points. So how do you think this dissonance might have been avoided by greater public participation in the redistricting process?
Well, by actually pointing that out. Here, when we participated in the IRC's public comment period, we pointed out to the fact that the plans proposed by the IRC were diluting Hispanic representation or potential Hispanic representation, so that the ultimate set of plans that they sent to the legislature corrected those failings. Certainly, when you have a special master's drawing those plans, and you only have an opportunity at a hearing in a remote area of the state for where the vast majority of the residents of the state live, which is downstate, you preclude the opportunity of the public from participating. I'm pointing to whatever failings there may be in particular maps.
Do you have a sense of to what extent Latino communities of interests actually showed up to those hearings?
Unfortunately, I do not. I know that there were something like 28 hearings between July and December sponsored by the IRC, but unfortunately, I don't think that there was a breakdown as to which communities turned out to participate. There were some organized groups, such as Latino Justice, Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, and others that did participate and testify. And actually propose maps themselves, but it's hard to get a sense because those data were not released by the IRC.
Just, you know, unscientifically, did you have a sense that there was word out in the community that these hearings were happening?
For people who are attentive to the press and to these political processes generally, they knew that redistricting was taking place. I know that we have been holding webinars since March of last year, but that doesn't mean that most people who are mildly interested in the political process knew about the redistricting process, or if they knew, it was very distant from their everyday lives. So unless we are able to show people what impact redistricting may have on their daily lives or on their lives generally, people are not going to be participating.
You know, we said earlier the census, it happens every 10 years. And obviously, we just had one, which I imagine was severely impacted by COVID. A lot of people did not get their census forms back in. It seems like we have an opportunity now, since the next one is 10 years away, to institutionally make some changes in our communities so that there is more representation the next time around. What efforts do you see headed in that direction?
We need to inform people as to what the purpose of the census is, and it is not just about bringing resources to those communities, and it is one of the purposes, but also what impact it may have in the politics of people. You know, in the last census, there was a 5% undercount of the Hispanic population in the United States. And that was greater than the 1.5% undercount that took place in 2010. There was an undercount of the non-Hispanic black population. There was an overcount of the non-Hispanic white population. So we see that there are differences, and that all had to do not just in terms of the outreach, but in the attempts at manipulating the census process itself.
Right. You know, as a League of Women Voter member and speaking for other good government and voting groups, boy, was there a reach out effort made. It was door to door. It was radio station. It was multilingual notices put into neighborhood mailboxes, you know, and it just did not work sufficiently or satisfactorily. So I guess what I'm saying now is that it calls for a new approach, and we have, in fact, 10 years to try to get it correct, but it we need to do more. So I know Tamar and I are in agreement with you. And just a final item for me is the irony of working through and creating an independent redistricting commission that was added to the state constitution in 2014 in order to bring more power to the public, more responsibility and decision-making power to the public, and how in the end it was legislature, judicial, special masters, and not at all the public.
And a judge in upstate New York.
And a judge in upstate New York. Right. So work needs to be done.
Yeah, we need to go back to the drawing board, reconceive the IRC. Perhaps we may want to start by having an odd number of members on the IRC, through whatever amendments we need to make to the Constitution. Even if there was no change to the IRC, the legislature also needed to let the process play out until the end before it intervened, as it was also required to do.
Mm.
The legislature jumped the gun. They could have waited until February 28th, but they decided to move prior to that date.
So, Carlos, who would your dream team be to start the process? Representatives from what government or private groups to really take a, from ground up, reconstruction census and redistricting?
Definitely it's a state responsibility, so it must come from the state government. And specifically, it is a responsibility of the state legislature. We know how fraught that process is in Albany, but it is their responsibility. It is then incumbent on people who have influence over the legislature to press legislators to craft an IRC or some other body that is truly effective in drawing districts that are representative of the state population.
So on that note, we'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Carlos Vargas Ramos, for his time and thoughtful comments. So the ballot box is going to be on hiatus during July and August. You can join us for our next show on Wednesday morning, September 21st on WVOX 1460 AM. And if you are a registered political party member able to participate in primary elections, do not forget to get out and vote in early voting at your local polling place through June 26th or on primary day itself, which is June 28th. And we have this other second primary election, which is new to our experience here in New York State, which will be held on August 23rd. And that one will be for New York State Senate and for Congress. So we have two primaries, just to get this clear, one June 28th and one August 23rd. So it's a busy voting summer, and hopefully everyone gets out to vote. So
thank you again, Dr. Vargas Ramos, and hopefully we will stay in touch and maybe see things happen and make them happen together in the coming decade.
So have a great day and a healthy summer, everyone. Thank you for listening to The Ballot Box. And, I wanted to add just quickly, if I could slip this in, because this is big news, Nina. This week, I don't know if you were aware of it, and the League of Women Voters certainly was on top of this issue. Governor Hochul signed the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act. It's an effort to protect minority communities from discriminatory election law changes in New York State. Had you seen that?
I did not. This is good news.
This is excellent news because it sort of touches on a little bit of what we were talking about on today's show. This law is going to, it's intended to prevent local officials from enacting rules that might suppress people's voting rights because of their race. And we are the first state to enact such strong and comprehensive protection. So, yay, New York State.
Congratulations to us. All right, take care.
All right.
Thank you, everybody.
Have a great day, everyone, and a
lovely, healthy
summer
till we hear you and speak to you in September.
America's home of free speech, continuing the legacy.